This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
We have the right now, on the terms of the dominant civilization, to express our desire to be dissidents, awkward, cross-grained critics, not compliant. They will continuously blow the whistle and ask us to run faster to catch up with them, but we don't really have to if where they are going is biocidal, planetary annihilation. We want the right to difference. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Picking up on our discussions of yesterday, let's see if we can drill down a little bit further into what we mean by the idea of Deen al-Fitra. We had a kind of initial sketching of the ground yesterday, but let's see if we can get any further into it. Not least because in our contemporary context, we find that humanity's Promethean rebellion against nature, the Enlightenment in a certain sense, man's mastery of nature rather than harmonious conviviality with it. It was a rebellion against matter, against stuff, against beauty as much as it was against the church, has now pitched us into a peculiar situation, unprecedented. We are in the Anthropocene era, where the principal geological and geomorphological influence on the surface of the planet is actually a species, namely ourselves. We are having the kind of impact that glaciers used to have. We are fundamentally transforming things, but in an infinitesimally smaller biological, historical, paleontological time frame. This is what we are doing. Essentially, from the perspective of the planet, what we do is we dig up minerals in great big holes in some places in the world, and we complexly turn them into things that we briefly use, and then we bury the junk into other great big holes in the world. It's our principal activity. It's a kind of geological model of what Bani Adam is up to at this point. And it's clear that this is unsustainable, and you don't have to belong to the zealots of Extinction Rebellion to see that infinite human desires, finite planetary resources, equals at some point either extinction or a paradigm shift, as yet unimagined. This puts us in an interesting situation, because for so long, first of all Christian Europe, and then Enlightenment Europe, and then communist Europe and fascistic Europe was bellowing at us, telling us to change, to comply, to conform. The dominant paradigm was that of the West, and we had to jump on this bandwagon. Now, however, we have a materialistic, not a spiritual or even a moral reason not to want to do that. And it's very hard for our reason to be refuted. Why should we trade up to the structures, the worldview, the paradigms, the economics of a system that is going to suffocate us all within a couple of generations? Doesn't really sound very appealing. The paradigm itself, triumphalistically proclaimed as the final point of the evolution of human society and thought, turns out to be so clever that we are running the risk of extinguishing ourselves. So wise is Homo sapiens that he can even bring about his own termination, which no other species can quite do. That's pretty smart. So we have the right now, on the terms of the dominant civilization, to express our desire to be dissidents, awkward, cross-grained critics, not compliant. They will continuously blow the whistle and ask us to run faster to catch up with them, but we don't really have to if where they are going is biocidal, planetary annihilation. We want the right to difference. This is an interesting point, that even the scientific paradigm turns out to be a kind of termination. So, in this context, what do we mean when we say, Islam Deen al-Fitra, Is this the framing of our tradition that we need to be preferring in order to make this case for dissident non-compliance? The religion of nature, is this what we mean by fitra? Almost, sort of, not quite. Fatara means to burst out. It's what seeds do, but it means something emerging from something else. One of Allah's names is Al-Fatir. Fatir as-samawati wal-ard. He is the one who brings everything into being from the primal, not even a void. And nature, therefore, refers not just to what in Arabic is called al-hayat al-fitriya, which is kind of biological things growing and tweeting, but rather stuff itself in its inherently improbable and miraculous and magical quality as muhdath, originated. The strangest thing about it, why is there stuff? Matched only by the paradox of our ability to ask that question. The mysteries are hardwired into the whole system, and no amount of philosophizing has really come up with a decisive argument. Existence, the fact of manifestation, is a puzzle. Looking for that God particle, for that universal theory, but each time there's a particle, there's another one, and of course they can't get to that because that's the paradigm itself. Consciousness, also, not even a scientific term. So this idea of fitra, the fatir, which is to do with creation and also to do with nature, but also to do with the right, reasonable, in the proper sense, human relationship to creation. Because when we say kullu mawludin yuladu ala al-fitra, every child is born according to the fitra, we don't mean that he's part of the world of cats and dogs and that sort of fitra, nor yet that he is part of the created world, because that's kind of too obvious a thing to say. But the fitra is within us as well. It's in some odd way. And clearly, if today's discourse is about the danger of extinction, and Islam is saying something very indicative about our relationship to nature and consciousness's relationship to nature, we need to try and get our heads around this. One way of triangulating is to see what Enlightenment thinkers themselves thought they were looking at when they looked at Islam. And this is the generation that was pushing back not so much against belief in God, even though it was often quite deistic and numinous, but a kind of Voltairean, écraser l'infâme, anti-clericalism. The Catholic Church is the source of all the evils of the world, and when we saw that Notre Dame fire, we forgot that for 20 years it was a temple of nature. After the French Revolution, the priests were chased out and killed, and they dressed up a young woman in a red dress and called her the spirit of nature and reason, and people were supposed to go there in order to contemplate this. And still in parts of France, and I've encountered this hiking myself, you come across a place that's called Temple à la Nature. You're supposed to go in and somehow transcendentally experience the wonders of the natural environment around you. It was a big thing as Europe emerged with a crash from centuries of Christian piety and became very modern, actually, very quickly. So this idea of the Enlightenment as being kind of not particularly against even kind of romantic ideas of nature as indicating the sublime, major theme of 19th century music and poetry, but really not in a Christian mode. Goethe, for instance, really not very Christian, but really interested in nature, interested in human beings, and interested in Islam as well, is one of the interesting moments in the evolution of our continent, where at points you start to get the sense amongst European intellectuals that here is a theistic alternative that is not weighed down by what Nietzsche would define as the anti-Dionysian traits of Christianity, and Charles Taylor in his new book, A Secular Age, where he's musing about the reasons why Christianity doesn't really hold the attention of young people in the West, says, well, that's because it doesn't affirm the Dionysian. This is the Nietzschean idea of the Apollonian, which is about sort of the ascetical transcendence and the illumination of the mind through leaving the flesh behind, and the Dionysian, which is more like the mystery religions of ancient Greece, where people are wearing garlands and dancing with nymphs in forest clearings and engaging with immanence rather than transcendence. And Nietzsche's view is that Christianity cannot deal with that, and that's Charles Taylor's explanation for the draining away of faith amongst young Christians, because nowadays it's all about the body and sexuality, and Christianity doesn't go there. So from that Enlightenment perspective, we find some very interesting hints, and somebody called Eric Ormsby has a new book coming out later this year, which is about Goethe and his relationship to Islam. Goethe, famous for writing his West-Eastern Divan, Westöstlicher Divan, after he'd been inspired by reading some slightly dodgy German translations of Persian mystics. But he produces this great long book-length classic of German literature, which is written in emulation of Hafiz, basically, and has a poem about Fatima and the famous Mohammedsgesang, which is his poem, which is Naat, basically, his Naat in praise of the Holy Prophet. And in this we find something that is quite characteristic, and Ormsby is teasing this out, of a certain Enlightenment romantic understanding of Islam as, first of all, partaking in an oriental wisdom from the Morgenland, the land where the sun arises and not where the sun sets, which is the end of things, but wisdom, light, truth, it's quite Platonic. And the kind of mystique of the Orient, the land of initiatic miracles and wonders. And at the same time, in Goethe, you get the idea of the Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, as a kind of personification of the Dionysian Enlightenment spirit. And this short poem that he has, the Mohammedsgesang, which Schubert set to music, and has been set to music by others over the years, is a very interesting image in which the Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, is compared to a mountain stream, vigorous, virile, sort of running through the rocks and the high mountains. And of course, the stream's origin is precipitation and hence heaven. But it's definitely in the earth and of the earth. And then as it reaches the valley, it spreads out and becomes the basis for great cities and civilizations. And that's his understanding of the fecundating hand of the prophetic intervention. A very interesting moment in European literature, and it's become, in some quarters, a kind of anthem for European Islam. But what he seems to be indicating is that here you have clearly a sacred prophetic figure, because Altenvater, his sort of father, is the one from whom he comes and to whom he returns. That's not an Islamic term. We don't speak in terms of filiation or fatherhood in our ideas of the human-divine relation, but that's not really important. Goethe is not trying to be writing an aqidah. He's just singing as a poet. And here you have the idea of the human as being of divine origin, the human also as engaging with and being in some sense part of the natural world and enhancing the natural world, so that it's a fecundating principle. And the Jüngling, the young prophet, is one who is really the spirit of youthful masculinity. It's a kind of futuwa idea, but very much could almost refer to one of the Bacchic or the Eleusinian mysteries of ancient Greece. And this is probably why the philosopher Herder, who's more or less the same period, a little bit later, sort of romantic Hegelian, says that Islam is a form of shamanism. Normally we would regard that as peculiar, because after all, aren't the Quraysh shamans, and Islam is the monotheistic thing that is at daggers drawn with the shamanism and the fetishism of Quraysh. So what does he mean by shamanism? Well, what they're looking at, particularly in that, you know, they have access to the Quran and access to not really much Islamic theology or law, but they certainly have Rumi and Hafiz and Sa'di at their disposal, is the idea of a kind of religion of celebration, a religion of carnival, a religion of the affirmation of life. So it's kind of like Bergson, it's the life spirit, it's the quintessential Hegelian Geist. It's represented in this Dionysian tradition that seems almost providentially to be the alternative, the abrogator of the Christian impulse with its Apollonian, ascetical, anti-flesh, celibate tendencies, which is one of the things that the Enlightenment was most appalled by. So that's an interesting moment. And the idea of Islam as not just something that's interesting and exotic and mystical because it comes from the East, and the idea that you get a little bit in this country, maybe with the Arabian Nights and Fitzgerald's translation of Omar Khayyam, but it was a lot bigger in Germany. But also something that's connected to nature, that combination becomes very significant. And that seems to be why Herder is saying Islam is a form of shamanismus, shamanism. That the worship of Islam is a form of incantation through nature, reflecting not the presence of transcendence through a Eucharist, matter that isn't matter, a piece of God. God himself has to come into the world in order to make anything good of the world, but rather the sense that God is already present, tashbih, and therefore there doesn't need to be a cosmic sacrifice, which is another of the sort of bêtes noires of the Enlightenment, the dying God, the world so evil and human nature so corrupted that only an infinite sacrifice by God himself can sort us out. This ontological pessimism about human nature, which was another of the things that the Enlightenment detested about, certainly a sort of Jansenistic, Augustinian type of Catholic Christianity. They wanted to be optimistic about human nature, and that reaches nowadays a certain sort of crazy apotheosis with the idea that whatever you desire is something that the world should be recognizing and affirming. But that wasn't the original plan. So you have this, as it were, independent, non-denominational, but generally anti-Christian perception of Islam, and it comes in Nietzsche as well. Nietzsche says, if Islam despises Christianity, it is 1,000 times right to do so, because Islam presupposes men. In other words, he likes the virility of the prophetic Islamic model. He doesn't like the anemic idea of Christianity, which denies Eros and Thanatos, desire and warriorhood, which for Nietzsche are the life principle itself and what makes us truly human within the natural world, but capable of transformation. So another thinker, phobic about Christianity, but interested in Islam. The idea of Islam as generating a kind of superman, as genuinely inhabiting the flesh and political responsibilities. Ian Alban's written about this. He has a book about Islam in 19th century German philosophical thought. Very interesting evolution. So without trying to make too much of that, we might make it a starting point for our reflection on what the fitra is all about. If outsiders look at us and they say, not the religion of flagellation, not the religion of ontological pessimism, but a religion essentially that is life-affirming, but still very much a religion. This is, and not hedonistic in the kind of alternative Marquis de Sade Enlightenment sense, but something that has a discipline to it, we find that Islam seems to play a rather interesting role, potentially, not really actually, because most Muslims don't really think in these terms. We're too moralistic nowadays, too focused on halal and haram, and we don't think about the deep nature of the religion and what it's doing in history and what it's for, which is unfortunate, but it's, as we know, how we are. We're not really intellectuals, we Muslims nowadays. We deal with crisis issues all the time. So this idea of the religion of the fitrah, the not just creation, but the natural world, which is a part of creation, and also a created, ingrained, innate human disposition to understanding the world in a natural and correct way, is part of what we mean really by Islam as Abrahamic religion and also as primordial. Al-Hanifiyyati Samha, with which he was sent, Ali Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the kind of generous, tolerant, Abrahamic monotheism. That's what he's describing his religion as to us. Bu'ithtu bil Hanifiyyati Samha. I've been sent with the tolerant, generous, noble, Abrahamic monotheistic way. Two words in Arabic becomes rather a lot in English, but that's the kind of concept. So there's something Abrahamic about it, but also something primordial and pre-Abrahamic. And this is related to Islam's understanding as the culmination of two great cycles in the history of the divine human engagement. The smaller cycle, which is not so small, is the cycle initiated by Ismail, alayhi salam, and whose basic themes we reenact as part of the Hajj, part of whose significance is the return to the center in an Abrahamic mode. So Abraham becomes the patriarch through Isaac, but also through Ishmael. And through Isaac you have most of the prophets, Joseph, Moses, Sayyidina Isa, that's the line of Ishaq, and the line of Ismail, kind of, it's a stream like Zamzam that gets buried, and then symbolically it's unearthed again, and the Ishmaelite Hagarene well is once again re-established. The significance of that being, of course, Ishmael's half-Gentile blood because his mother is Egyptian, and therefore this is to be the cycle within Abrahamic monotheism that isn't just for the chosen people but for everybody. I'm sent to all mankind as one of his khasa'is, one of his unique features, the universal prophet, who is sent providentially precisely at that point where the ancient world comes to an end and the medieval world and the beginnings of the global world begin. So that's the closure of the lesser cycle, the Ishmaelite cycle. And there is, if you read Charles-André Gillis's book about the symbolism of the Hajj, which is largely drawn from Ibn Arabi, a lot of geometrical and natural symbolism in the basic forms of the Hajj and the proportions of the Kaaba, and that's a whole world, the existence of the basic geometrical forms, the point, the circle, the square, the cube, the straight line, it's all primordially there and inhabited and reenacted by those who are alchemically transformed by going through those archaic motions. But the larger cycle is the one, the biggest cycle of all, the one that begins with Adam and Alastu bi Rabbikum. And the Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, again through his connection to the Meccan sanctuary, the Jerusalem sanctuary doesn't have Adamic resonance, but the Meccan sanctuary does, when the Kaaba was just Rabwa Hamra, as the historians say, just a little red mound, the Kaaba itself built, of course, by Abraham and his son much later. But still, the Axis Mundi, the center of the world, and whose starting point for the rituals, the circles, the straight lines, all of those enactments, which have such a profound effect on the soul, is the black stone. The black stone is the symbol of the day of Alastu Bi Rabbikum. That Sayyidina Ali, in a famous khabar, says to Sayyidina Omar, who is weeping, Sayyidina Omar kisses the stone, فَقَبَّلَهُ Omar, ثُمَّ بَكَى حَتَّى عَلَى نَجْشِيجُ, and then he wept until his sobbing was audible. And then he says, Sayyidina Omar says to the black stone, إِنِّي أَعْلَمُ أَنَّكَ حَجَرٌ لَا تَضُرُّ وَلَا تَنْفَعُ ولولا أني رأيت رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم يقبل ما قبلتك. I know you're just a stone, you can't help me, you can't hurt me, and but for the fact that I'd seen the Holy Prophet kiss you, I wouldn't kiss you. فالتفت فإذا بعلي أمير المؤمنين. And he turned around, there's Ali, كرم الله وجهه, and he says, بل يضر وينفع. It does help and it does harm. قال كيف؟ قال إن الله لما أخذ الميثاق على الذرية. Truly Allah, when he took the covenant, that أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ بَلَى شَهِدْنَا, from all of the descendants, those who were to be the descendants, the future generations, he took this covenant. ثُمَّ أَلْقَمَهُ الْحَجَرُ, and then he fed it. Everybody's bala shahidna, yes, we bear witness to the stone. فَهُوَ يَشْهَدُ لِلْمُؤْمِنِ بِالْوَفَاءِ وَعَلَى الْكَافِرِ بِالْجُحُودِ. So it bears witness to the faithfulness of the believer and the rebellion of the unbeliever. Now there's kind of mystery there. What could it mean for all of these bala shahidnas to be fed to the black stone? This is metaphysical, not physical. But that's the labaik, and that's the meaning of the Kaaba, which is the symbol of the mysterious center of the world, and al-Bayt al-Ma'mur, and the origin of things, and we go around it. Our experience there of worship is in circles. Everywhere else it's straight lines, but there we're in a different modality. There is, as it were, presence more than there is absence. And so the Kaaba represents, and that dimension of the Hajj, because the Hajar is not part of the Abrahamic story particularly, that represents the Adamic origin, the primal Kaaba, the original Al-Bayt al-Atiq, the ancient house. So that's the really big cycle. And Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, one of the aspects of his being Khatam al-Nabiyyin, seal of the prophets, is that he seals this Abrahamic story, which includes the Jewish-Christian thing, beautifully, by including Jerusalem and by including Isaac. It's a way of inclusion, and he leads all the prophets in prayer. لَا نُفَرِّقُ بَيْنَ أَحَدٍ مِّن رُسُلٍ. But also this bigger cycle is the cycle that is everything. And of course, finally, there is the final prayer offered by anybody on earth, which is his shafa'a for his ummah. So a cosmic function indeed. But if we look at these ancient rituals and we see Islam's deliberate understanding of itself as something very old and primordial from a time, before the Bronze Age, who knows, when these things originate. And then we look at the basic patterns of the Muslim life. We do find that they are, you might say, fitriya. That is to say, they require no paraphernalia. They require no mediation. And they are intensely embodied. And they embed us in the physical world insofar as when you are in the mosque, you face the Qibla, and that immediately gives you a grounding in terms of the points of the compass and where you are, and you have a sense of direction. It's a spiritual GPS. It's like those Mauritanian sheikhs who they say have a kind of ability to know the Qibla even if they close their eyes. I've never seen that, but people say that some people can do that. But that determines the Muslim life in so many ways, and we wish to be buried facing the Qibla. That's the way we wish to face. That is, again, a very ancient kind of thing that doesn't really have a Christian equivalent. Christian churches used to be built towards the east because the rising sun's the symbol of the risen Christ, but it's not really indispensable. So there is that, but there is also, as we mentioned yesterday, the very striking fact of the solar and the lunar determination of the Muslim life through our sacred acts, that we believe in lunar months, and the Quran speaks strongly against those who introduce intercalatory months to try and make things seem easier to deal with. إِنَّمَا النَّسِيءُ زِيَادَةٌ فِي الْكُفْرِ, that kind of declamation, the intercalatory month that will give you 365 days rather than 10 and a bit days less, is an excess of unbelief. And the reason for that is that if you do that, then you are abolishing sacred time, cyclical time, and taking you into the artificiality, the convenient calendar of linear time, and Islam is exactly not about doing that. And the basic, as it were, ontological question behind all of these endless moon sighting controversies, and I got yet another email this morning about some new conference that was going to solve that finally. And, the ontology of that is that it is ultimately indeterminate, as the moon is a mysterious thing. The sun is pretty reliable, you can always tell what the sun will do. The moon, astronomers will tell you, it depends on all kinds of variations about altitude, and it's predicting where the moon will be seen. Depends not just on where you are and whether there's clouds, but on a lot of other variables as well. And it's unpredictable, which is, don't quote me, perhaps one reason why most languages sun is masculine and moon is feminine. But I'll leave that one hanging. Sol, luna, it's, in most languages this is the case. But the subtlety of it is that it determines our lives, and there is a deep wisdom in those traditional Muslim communities where they pay no attention to the mufti on the radio, but they go up the nearest hillside and drink tea and sing songs until they've actually seen the moon. And that is something that could have happened 100,000 years ago when Paleolithic man used lunar calendars, and we know because we've dug up the tally sticks that have exactly that number of days on them. It's something very, very, very old. And although it's insufficiently understood, and a lot of biologists are upset by it, human biorhythms, and not just female biorhythms, seem to be geared quite closely to the phases of the moon. And the secretion of certain enzymes and hormones is said by many researchers to have something to do with that, and it's some ancient biological thing. And insomnia, in the middle of the month, people tend to sleep less well when the moon is full, even if the curtains are drawn, and they've done experiments with people sleeping underground in mines, and they find, even if they don't know what the phase of the moon is, still when the moon is full, they find it harder to sleep. These are deep mysteries to do with a very basic level of human consciousness and the brain and our metabolism, but the Sharia connects us to all of that. These are Layali al-Bid, the white nights, and those fast those days, particular kinds of devotion, ways in which in your conscious life you can reflect something that's actually very subconscious and primordial. So yeah, Islam is very ancient in that it insists on taking us back into sacred time, the time of our remote Paleolithic ancestors, and is the religion of fitra in that sense. And the prayer, of course, the prayer is more to do with the sun than with the moon, but again reconnects us to a time when the human body, metabolism, activities, sacred life was determined by the unavoidable fact of the rising and the setting of the sun, these circadian rhythms, again fundamental to whom we are. I once talked late at night to an ambulance driver who was complaining that he was always working at night, and he said, I know that my life expectancy is about 5 years less than everybody else because I'm working at night and the human body really is not designed for that. So the awareness of the rising and the setting of the sun, again, something fundamental to what we are. The use of water, very, very ancient, the symbolism of it. It comes from heaven, so it's pure, and we want to keep it pure, particularly for ritual purposes. And it outwardly touches those parts of us that are most associated with sinfulness, and we feel somehow in a very primal way that helps us to be cleansed of the things that those limbs have been doing. And this is what psychologists sometimes refer to as the Macbeth effect. You remember, out vile spot, she tries to get rid of it after the murder, and it doesn't come. And very often people who've suffered personal injury find that it's therapeutically helpful to take a shower or to take a bath afterwards. Deep in the human psyche, this need for cleansing assisted by water. We have that. And so many other things could be adduced. So the point of historical origin of these practices is basically the Meccan sanctuary, in other words, the Abrahamic, but also the Adamic sanctuary. And so they carry within themselves these qualities of the fitra, the primordial disposition, and there is something ancient about them. The simplicity of our worship. We don't use organs ever. We don't adorn our worship through historically evolved forms. We don't change the liturgy. It is that ancient primeval thing that was shown by the angel on the night of the Mi'raj. It remains that angelic representation of the cyclical nature of human life and the evolution of the spirit. And its climax is pressing the forehead to the earth, zameen, the ground. Minha khalaqnakum wa fiha nu'idukum. From it we created you, to it we shall return you, from it we will raise you up one more time. This earthiness of Islam is a fundamental idea. Adam, they say his name, Adam, because he was created from the earth, Adim al-Ard. Arabic Adim means kind of earth, clay, surface of the ground. He was clay. So we are connected again to the Adamic origins of the great cycle through these forms of ibadah. And other cases could be adduced. The Hajj we've already referred to as our representation of something that is present in all sacred cultures, of a journey that outwardly, sacramentally enacts the inward journey back to the center. We spiral in back to the presence of the one who has no place, but whose house this is. And as we turn, the points of the compass become less clear, and the outside world, we don't remember even which way the hotel is or where we left our slippers, because we've been going round and round. We've all had that experience. And that's precisely to take you out of linearity and geography and into the focus, the moth around the flame of the divine presence. Nowadays, of course, you've got the Novotel and the giant clock and all of those things sort of saying, look at me, but we shouldn't look at them because they've precisely misunderstood the nature of tawaf. It'll take you into a circularity, which is about love, the kind of wandering in love, the intoxication of proximity with the divine in that extraordinary place. So the Hajj, and Jalisi's book talks about this a lot. Ibn Arabi has this amazing chapter on the Hajj, which is kind of so full of insights and speculations and calculations. It's worth getting some sense of that tradition just to increase your sense of awe and trepidation and respect when you go to the Holy City. That's really important because the gifts there are inconceivable. Allah is, that's his house. Those who are there are his guests. Duyuf al-Rahman. So don't mess around with looking at the clock. Or you've got a watch, you don't need to look at the clock. I don't know if the Saudis realise, everybody nowadays has a watch, and there's a Nigerian lady outside the Bab al-Safa who sells them for just 5 riyals. So you don't need to spend a billion producing the world's biggest clock. But anyway, it's easy to get distracted by all of that. But yeah, approaching the house with due reverence. And Imam Ghazali is very good at this in the Kitab Adab al-Hajj in the Ihya Ulum al-Din. It's a place of majesty. Jalal, Mecca, the Jamal, Medina more. So watch out and have a sense that all of these practices are ancient and unchanged and have a very deep effect. How? Well, we can understand that as well as we understand how the sub-basement of our prehistoric inherited mind might work. You don't really understand what's this Arafat and the throwing of stones. It's a deep psychology in all of those things, but to try and rationalize it out, you get... This is what Herder is talking about when he says shamanism. He's not saying Muslims have lots of interesting statues and go into trances. And it's to do with almost a very ancient, primeval, prehistoric type of religion that is nonetheless uncompromisingly monotheistic, so Adamic and Abrahamic at the same time, and Hajj is the representation of that. And then the prayer we referred to, and of course Ramadan, sacred communities always have forms of fast. كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ. Fasting is for you as it was for those who came before you, as an important way of reminding you of your interrelated connection to the natural world, because generally the more absently you eat and drink, the less you are aware of your dependence on those things and the miraculous nature of those things. And therefore in primordial societies there was always, just that there were sacred places, there were also sacred times, and fasting was one of the ways in which that could be marked off. So the fast also reconnects us to a very distant time without being shamanistic, obviously. And one could continue with the other basic practices of Islam and some of its most characteristic features, like its understanding of gender, for instance, is very, very primal and essentializing. Laysa dhakaru kal untha, the male is not like the female. The female has her form of incomparable perfection. The angels bowed down to her as well. The male has his form of incomparable perfection. We have maybe in ourselves, in our realities, 1% of either of those things, but that which we are invited into is the dignity of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or Fatima or Aisha, immense people, giants, with certain qualities that are very difficult to express in the mere net of words, but are particularly emphasized in the Islamic context. So one could go through the entirety of the religion, I think, and reflect on the fact that it comes from that very ancient, unchanged Arabian place, and is specifically in its recapitulation of revelatory history, that which takes us back in certain of its key respects to an ancient time of sacred places, sacred times of incantations, of an extraordinary reverence for the sanctity of the word. Plato thought that human civilization started to go downhill as soon as writing was invented. But the orality of the prayer and the orality of hifz, specifically respected in this ummah, are from that original fact that he is a Nabi al-Ummi, alayhi salatu wasalam. So he's pre-Platonic. He doesn't contaminate the word, and it's not contaminated by scratching it on parchment, but it is a breath within him. It is the word rather than just words on paper. And that's another really important part of how we engage with the divine, that this speech, this ancient phenomenon the origin of human culture is speech. It's not visual arts or architecture or anything. It's speech. Allamahul bayan. That's when we recognizably, you know, in our Adamic sense, are human. That is the modality through which we face the Creator, through speech, the miracle of speech from the Iqra. That is our form. But speech that is not just kalamun nas, any old talk, but God's speech. And very quickly we have the doctrines against the Mu'tazilites that affirm the real logical implication of the Qur'an's self-understanding as kalamullah, that it is God's uncreated speech. And therefore, as we resonate with the word, we breathe something of the sanctity of the divine, because this is not like any other set of sounds. This is God's own breath that is within us. That when we hear the Qur'an recited, or when the Qur'an is, as it were, recited through us, that's the Holy Prophet's speech, and it's the speech of our Qur'an teachers, and the speech of Jibreel, but in this very mysterious, as it were, also unlettered way, the divine speech. And that's our principal contact with the divine. So there's something of the soothsayer here, something of the one who is simply the passive recipient of a message of transcendence. It's been heard before, the Qur'an is the Qur'an, but there's something very ancient about what the imam is doing for his congregation. He's not dishing out little wafers or holding things up. He is breathing with the divine spirit. It's a very pared down, nomadic, Semitic, primal idea of how the sacred is made present, the breath, because ruh is related to rih, which is wind, it's an insufflation. So through all of these things, it seems to me, we can start to understand this characterization that we have of Islam as the religion of the fitra, the primordial natural disposition. It's perhaps so un-Christian and un-Western a concept that we don't have a single word that begins to do it justice, but sometimes we say primordial natural disposition. It's too many syllables, but it's the best that our language can do. And if that is what we are, now despite the carping of the Maulvi Saabs and the crazy stuff that's happening, that's essentially what the gift of Islam is. In the midst of our high-tech, crazy, demented, biocidal modernity, a package from a really ancient time, a normative human response to transcendence, not pagan at all, emphatically monotheistic, but not from the complexities of civilization, but something very simple. This makes Islam look really relevant and significant, like the key to open the lock that has closed modern man off from the sacred, because the church is complex and Judaism seems to be for a particular people. And Buddhism, the West will only have if they cherry pick, as we saw earlier today, the bits that they like. Yesterday, I was talking to one of my colleagues in the divinity faculty who was telling me, as according to traditional Buddhism, a woman cannot achieve enlightenment. But when she reaches a particularly high degree, she is compassionately turned into a man, and then she can become arahat, achieve enlightenment. And then I said, how many Western Buddhists actually have taken on that aspect of Buddhism? And kind of smiled. Westerners just sort of created bespoke Buddhism. But with Islam, nobody allows you to do that. No, Islam is the Muhammadan way, with all of the ijtihad in the usul and all of that, because it's an intelligent way. But it is, in essence, this ship of salvation from a distant past that gives us a normatively human way of being when everything else seems to be inhuman, as we move into an age of genetic manipulation and artificial intelligence and climate breakdown and God knows what other wonderful things the scientists have in store for us. We have these practices that nobody seriously is trying to fiddle with. You go into a place of worship of other religions and you don't really know what to expect. Except for one thing, what you won't see there is how the founder of that religion used to worship. But anything else, anything goes. In Islam, you know, the miracle of the divine hefz of this ummah is you go into any mosque, just about in the ummah, there'd be 20 million mosques, and you're going to see people following sallu kama ra'aytumuni usalli, prayers you've seen me prayed, this power of the idea of the sunnah, and this disgust at the idea that anybody might want to do something else thinking that it's better, the true understanding of bid'ah. And bid'ah is a genuinely appalling thing because it means you're putting your own sense of what's right above the prophetic perfection. That's not a little thing. Has kept these forms intact, and Ramadan is still there, and zakat rules are still there, and it's something for which we need to give thanks and something which we need to hold on to. Al-urwatul wuthqa, the firmest handhold, specifically designed to give us a form, a fitri way, the sunnah, in an age where nobody seems to have any anchorage any longer, and humanity is moving in the direction of different genders and different sexualities and having race changes and redefining their age, and it's all come adrift. And a lot of people are suffering because human beings need landmarks. We're creatures of habit. So we need to be giving thanks for this. Alhamdulillah ala ni'matil Islam wa kafa biha ni'mah. The Quran says, praise be to Allah for the blessing of Islam. It is a sufficient blessing. Whatever else might be going on, we have this. We have a way of dealing with nature, with spouses, with God. Everything that's fundamental is still there and reconnects us quintessentially through nature. So that's my thought about what this claim that we have, that our religion is the religion of nature, Deen al-Fitra, might possibly mean. Wallahu subhanahu wa ta'ala a'lam. Barakallahu fikum wal afu minkum. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cambridge Muslim College, training the next generation of Muslim thinkers.